Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm subbing for Steve Shoemaker this afternoon. Steve is taking a well-deserved vacation to Alaska. I assume he's enjoying the views as we speak this afternoon. Our topic for this afternoon is a very interesting book that has received several awards by Luis Urrea, entitled Crossing the Devil's Highway, Immigration in the United States. It was published in 2004. Luis Urrea was the Pulitzer Prize finalist for The Devil's Highway, and it's essentially a book about the travails of Mexican immigrants. And we have with us someone who knows Luis as a guest on the program in the past, Reverend Mike Mulberry. Reverend Mulberry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Don. I really appreciate it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you got involved, first of all, with our community. I believe you've been senior pastor at Community United Church of Christ since 2003, 2004. Is that right?
Yeah, I was there until May of 2008 and became a part of kind of the founding person and leader for the new sanctuary movement while I was there. That's now in great hands with people like Carmel Salicki, Pat Sion, Barbara Kessel, a lot of great people in the community. I could go on and name a lot of different people from, I think we had at one time about 10 faith communities represented in the new sanctuary movement. Really a response to what we hear as a story kind of hatred and prejudice out in our communities aimed against immigrant peoples. And it comes over the airwaves pretty strong through traditionally through people like Lou Dobbs at CNN, who is very strong against the immigrant population. It's been seen in violence through Immigration and Customs Enforcement and also through violence that has had some right-wing militia groups take up the cause to kind of expunge the United States of people who they believe are taking advantage of the United States system.
Well, before we get too far into it, let me just make sure that our guests know that we are a call-in show, and if you have a comment or question about this topic or for Reverend Mulberry, you can call in at 333-9455. If you'd prefer to call an 800 number or you have only that option, the number is 1-800-222-9455. Well, I hope to talk more a little bit later about the new sanctuary movement. As I understand it, the Community United Church of Christ has had previous immigrants in the past from Eritrea, isn't that right, and other places?
Yeah, they were a church that I think mainly through the university helped out refugee peoples and had been important in providing hospitality for some of the international students. In fact, you know, there were people, for example, I think of somebody like Upson and Olive Garrigus, who were important in Upson came back from World War, one of the World Wars, saying that he was going to make sure nothing happened like that again. And so Upson would invite people from warring countries to come to the United States to study with him. And Olive would provide the hospitality for those people, and they would get them together so that they could broaden understanding. So there were significant people in the history of that church who worked with international communities to try to bring about some understanding and peace.
Now, after, I understand you went to Eden Theological Seminary, is that right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And then, as I understand it, you served a year as a missionary in Chiapas, Mexico?
I did. Between my second and third year of seminary, I went at the invitation of Bishop Samuel Ruiz Garcia in Chiapas. to work as a missionary in Mexico through the Illinois Conference of the United Church of Christ. Bishop Ruiz was looking to develop some understanding that although his diocese was providing hospitality for Guatemalan refugees in southern Mexico, there was also brewing underneath the surface in Mexico the need to hear some of the needs and struggles of the Mexican indigenous peoples. And I was just so impressed and found myself inspired by the bishop and his work. Many of his sermons to me sounded a lot like sermons that you would hear from King, because it wasn't 10 or 15 years ago when I was there that they had indigenous people and Ladino people walking on opposite sides of the street just because of the prejudice against the indigenous people there. And he was really working hard to dissipate that prejudice and also to lift up justice and a new path for his diocese.
Now, at the top of the program, I mentioned that our focus was on the poet and novelist Luis Urrea, who published a book that's received significant acclaim back in 2004, I believe it was, entitled Crossing the Devil's Highway, Immigration in the United States. And I, as I understand it, the you have met Luis, is that correct?
I have not met Luis, but I have corresponded with him a lot over the course of the past year. He is a guy with a great sense of humor about himself and can hardly believe that that his book has taken off like it has, but he has he continues to be a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago,
professor of creative writing, I think.
Yeah, correct. And he is a native of San Diego, which, much like the person who wrote and produced and directed the movie El Norte that showed up at Ebert Fest a few years ago, Luis has a particular perspective living in San Diego of what it means to have that great divide where why are things so terrible in Tijuana, and yet you just cross the border not a few feet away, and you have this incredible U.S. city in San Diego. And the disparity creates a disconnect that I think helps people ask important questions going forward. And so Luis really penned in The Devil's Highway, a book that has become the human face of the humane immigration movement, to recognize that these are people, that no one down to their bones is an illegal person, that's to say that someone's an illegal alien is not a legal statement, but a theological statement, and that is not something that's acceptable within Christian teaching, as we understand that all people are created in the image of God. That's where that starts off, and Luis is going to be here, be in Champaign-Urbana Friday of this coming week, where he'll be speaking at the Friday Forum Series at the University Y, which gets started just a little bit before 12, as Steve might say, you know, come and eat lunch there beforehand, while the speech is going on. And then he's going to be doing a book signing over at Pages for All Ages from 5 to 8 o'clock, and the New Sanctuary Movement has purchased tamales from El Toro, and there promises to be a reading by Luis of the book a couple of different times. And so we invite folks to come out to experience this and also to pick up the book if they haven't already done so, and start a book study of their own so that we all can begin to talk about immigration in a much more healthy way than we have to date in our country. It's been something that has shaped the presidential campaign to the point where John McCain doesn't even mention it, and that Barack Obama is not much better. We just find that there's such hatred out there that it has created a chilling effect in the presidential campaign.
Just to add a little bit for our listeners, the title of his Friday Forum talk is Crossing the Devil's Highway, Immigration in the United States. And he will be talking about that book, and the lunch is $6. And just to reiterate, as you said, Mike, the Pages for All Ages book signing and also a reading from 5 to 8 this coming Friday. Join us if you can make it. I think you'll find it very interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about his book first, and then we'll get into the related issues that certainly make up a central theme in your ministry. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and how it is that simply by telling the stories of these 26, what they call them, the Welton 26, who wandered across the border after being led off by coyotes, and many lost their lives, and Professor Rhea talks about this in excruciating detail, but he also has another theme as well, doesn't he? And that is to communicate something about the humanity of Mexicans as human beings, or immigrants
right.
as human beings.
He gives you some background on these folks so that you recognize that there are a lot more desperate stories than the ones shared in this particular story, but he helps you to understand that these folks are going like we all would because they have had to make difficult choices, many of them. A son in this situation goes with his father because he doesn't want his father to be alone. And as you shared, Don, the excruciating details sometime of their deaths, just how horrific it is to die of dehydration. And he shares some of that because it's poignant for understanding that you may think that immigrant folk have no place in the United States or should not take benefits and so forth and so on, but you know, you should also, we all should be aware that we, through our foreign and trade policy, have helped create this situation in which we've basically said, hey, if you can make it through this worst place in the Arizona desert, the actually a place where at times the heat will stay up over 120 degrees during the day and not get much below 100 during the night, then if you can make it through that gauntlet of death, you're welcome to our country because we have such things like Operation Hold the Line, Operation Triple Strike, Operation Rio Grande, all of these operations that have put more and more Border Patrol at our border and have funneled these people into this absolutely horrendous part of the Arizona desert. Those are some of the details that he meets out with this story, and it's
part of the story that's so interesting is the research and the process of gathering that research. It's quite a story.
Yeah, and I think it's always important to understand how the least and last experienced life, because I think what Scripture, at least the Scripture that I read, teaches me is that how the least and the last are moving about in the world is indicative of how the world is doing, how things are going for the world. They are the first ones to show us the symptoms of whether we have a compassionate and loving place or whether we are in a place that may be more hateful and spiteful than we would care for it to be. I think we saw that with Katrina and everything that happened with the natural disaster there. The last and the least in that disaster showed us, Katrina unmasked what was going on with people in the world. And that's not logic that we hear about very often, but it definitely is biblical logic when you think that the story that we're studying in the Revised Common Lectionary in the Protestant Church right now is a God who would come to slaves, Hebrew slaves, while they live in Egypt. And that's something that I believe is about the character of this God and the way this God works in the world.
I understand that one of your principles that you have attempted to practice in a lot of your ministry is that God is infused in all of creation. I take it that this has informed your work down in Chiapas. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, informs my ministry everywhere that there is a real sense that, you know, I think we say too often in the United States by default that we believe in the absence of God where there is pain and suffering and there is oppression and violence, and do not recognize that, but we do that by extracting resources from places where the most hurting are in the world. For example, is we can talk about Hurricane Ike seems to be dead set on, quite literally, on Haiti right now. We already know the suffering that's going on there. Well, where do we think God is in all of that? And do we think God is in that wind and that rain that is coming? Or do we think God is screaming and yelling and shouting present in Haiti, hoping against hope that the kind of natural occurrences that we have set up through our policies will not destroy the people in the land of Haiti?
Well, why is it you think that so many U.S. citizens still fear the undocumented workers and that they're allegedly stealing jobs from so-called real Americans? What is that about?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a legend of fear that has run throughout all of human history. And when you have the Fourth Estate, the media funneling that kind of fear out at people, when you have a situation where the only humane policy we talk about is when big business can get these people to work, and that's what we really need them for, our beasts of burden. You know, a good example of how that is put out there, Don, is President Bush has been one of the better people in terms of talking about humane immigration, you know, on the spectrum. Now, he's certainly not as far as I would want to go, but he talks about how immigrant peoples are willing to do the jobs that Americans are not willing to do. Well, is he right about that when you really think about it? And the answer is no, he's not right. Americans are willing to do those jobs, but Americans are not willing to do those jobs at the pay that those jobs are offered. And that's a very different thing to say. I detasseled corn when I was in high school, and it was pretty good money. It was one of the more horrendous jobs that I could think of, but I know that somebody else is detasseling corn now because they're willing to take much less money, below minimum wage, without any of the protections that I would have. And that's what we've got set up, is a situation where we've said we're willing to pay folks who are willing to take this low of money with no protections, and it's basically a rush to the bottom.
I came across this passage in Urea. He says, if only toilets would scrub themselves, pants stitch themselves, tuna can themselves, lawns mow themselves, if only tomatoes and oranges and apples and cotton and sugarcane and peaches and cherries could be harvested by monkeys, if we only had clones, if only Mexico paid workers a decent wage. That's from Luis Urrea.
And he's right about that, but it also does not recognize fundamentally, you know, I think one of the things that would be said out of this is that that there are middle class and upper middle class immigrant people in the United States that are undocumented, that are living lives of quiet desperation, hoping they won't be found out. And I think, but, you know, the people who are hurting the most in this situation and have the most to fear are folks who might expect Immigration and Customs Enforcement to show up at their door the next day to take away what little they have and possibly separate their families, which is one of the most pernicious parts of this immigration policy that we have in the United States, that we are fine and almost seem to be intentional in separating families. And we did that one other time in our economy with the slave trade, and that had devastating effects for a people and a culture that I think continue to this day. a culture of people who were more community-based and more family-based than a European culture, but we utterly ripped and destroyed the fabric of that. We're doing that now, and, you know, there's that Deuteronomic passage, you reap what you sow, and if we continue to do that, I just think that that's going to be devastating, not only for the immigrant communities, but for us as well down the road.
Now, why has his book, Urrea's book, The Devil's Highway, become such a almost an icon for the movement, particularly in the Southwest? It apparently has really received widespread good reviews and lots of people quoting from it. What is there about this particular book that Urrea will be reading from next Friday at Friday Forum? What is there about this that has made such an impact?
Well, I think part of it is because it's mythically true and people recognize that. You know, I think there's a difference between coming at, you know, he comes at folks with facts. There's no doubt about that. But he tells a story. He spins a good yarn. And it's a lot like the old Marcus Borg talks about the Navajo have a way of saying things in which a Navajo storyteller says, I don't know if it happened this way or not, but I know this story is true. And I think that he can't possibly know all the facts that happened with these guys who were lost and many of them who died in the desert. But he is reporting things that I think basically people in the Southwest know that that's a true story, down to their bones, that they have an experience that, yes, this is probably true, that these people are human and that they have real lives and that they have families and that they have real human concerns. And telling it in a story allows people to enter into it without getting caught up in saying, wow, you're just saying that. You're coming up with those facts and statistics because you have a particular viewpoint. I think it allows people to enter the story. And, you know, like you said, in Luis traveled to San Diego not too long ago, and as he was doing so, a four-year-old book, The Devil's Highway, was the most popular nonfiction, the bestseller in the San Diego area when he went. And I think that that says a lot for how this issue has come to the fore for so many people in our country.
Well, talk to us a little bit about his technique in that book. He, what I found remarkable in reading a good portion of it was that he did not demonize the Border Patrol officers. He told their stories as well. In fact, in some cases, redeeming stories. There's one story about a $6,000 tower that was built as a refuge so that if they ran out of water and were desperate, they could push a alarm bell and rescue would be within an hour. And that got all over the media, the right-wing media, and they trashed it and said, we're spending taxpayer dollars for this kind of thing, when in fact the Border Patrol officers themselves pool their money to, out of sympathy for these people, to build this tower.
Right.
I found that remarkable. Urrea seems to not see one side of the story.
Yeah, and I think that that's right. And I don't think that those are opposing sides, is that solidarity groups along the border will say, just like immigrant peoples, Border Patrol folks span the gamut in terms of their goodness or sometimes just being, you know, kind of a jerk, is that they have experienced people in the Border Patrol who have taken people on their backs whose feet are too blistered to walk them out of the desert. And if I remember right, you know, Luis kind of talks about with those Border Patrol folks how important it is to have a good vehicle with a good air conditioner in that part of the desert, and I think that does give you a sense of their humanness as well. And it should remind us all that the Border Patrol is not driving the hatred and the violence against the immigrant community in that neck of the woods. But it should also be remembered that much like our prisons throughout the United States, we are developing a border economy, in which we are becoming more and more dependent on the enforcement of a border that does not work at this time. And everybody agrees, from far right to far left, the border policy that we have now is not working.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the new sanctuary movement. How did that get started? You mentioned it earlier. And what are you hoping to do in connection with immigrants that we have today?
The new sanctuary movement was really started as we began to hear some of these stories about the immigrant peoples who were facing deportation, in particular immigrant families, and seeing those split up. And you may remember the young woman who was up at a United Methodist church in Chicago, and she gained
yes.
sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And she became iconic for what are we going to do about these situations. And out of Chicago, Interfaith Worker Justice, which is based there, called people across the nation to, what are we going to do to respond to some of these issues as we confront them? We really need to find a way to get a forum to talk about some of these issues. And we recognize that we faced the same thing in the 1980s when we had refugees fleeing across Central American borders into the United States, seeking some kind of sanctuary. That was the first sanctuary movement, and there were people like Father Tom Royer and Reverend Jim Holloman who were important in the Champaign-Urbana area for mm-hmm. making that making Champaign-Urbana a place of refuge and hospitality. And there were many more people who were involved in driving and, you know, much like the old Underground Railroad, making it possible. But that had a different flavor to it in that that was about hiding those refugee peoples out. The new sanctuary movement is really about going public with the fact that we want to provide some form of hospitality to immigrant peoples, so we might have a forum or a soapbox to say that you have heard all of this story about how immigrants are harmful for our economy and how things are bad, but we want the opportunity to tell you why the immigrant situation is the way it is, because that's rarely a question that is asked in this struggle, is why are immigrant peoples coming across? So the new sanctuary movement is an attempt to find a voice and tell the important faith story once again of hospitality, which is a bedrock value for all of the world religions. That hospitality. In fact, one of the incredible things that I think happened over a year ago to highlight what was going on is in San Diego, the faith communities got together. It was Passover happened the same week that Maundy Thursday was going on in the Christian church. And so one of the things they did was several of the pastors and rabbis and imams washed the feet of immigrants to remember Maundy Thursday service. They washed the feet of immigrant peoples, and then they all processed to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in San Diego and delivered bitter herbs, remembering the Passover and the Exodus story, to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, saying as the I'm trying to name the organization, and I'm dropping it right now, but a strong civil rights organization in the United States has referred to the immigrant situation as close to slavery. So we're trying to highlight this.
So it's primarily educational?
Yeah, it's educational, but it's also, I would say, it's consciousness and soul raising. It's about saying, what values are we going to live by through this struggle? Because it is a struggle, and we all are in different places in that struggle. But, you know, it begins, and what faith should say is we're going to begin with our values, and our values will teach us how to get to the other side. And what we have been doing so far has been dealing with, kind of stories that really don't, that are not based in any kind of reality. It's Lou Dobbs talking about how immigrant peoples are bringing leprosy across the border. Well, we find out that's not true. But you find out about that on page A4 when Lou Dobbs right. put it on page A1 at the start of his show. So.
Now, as I recall, the old sanctuary movement actually did harbor immigrants illegally. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep, it did.
Is the new sanctuary movement doing this as well?
Well, I think that that is a push on whether it is believed that we are harboring immigrant peoples illegally. And again, we begin to talk about many of the things that Dr. King talked about when we say this is, what law are we responding to? Is it God's law or human law as we deal with those? Because certainly hospitality is one of those things that is a part about God's law. The question is, in all of this, that what laws are we going to obey going forward? Is in Oklahoma, there is a state law out that if you are found giving aid or harbor to an undocumented person, any kind of medical aid or any kind of help whatsoever, it is a felony. And so, if you can imagine the Good Samaritan story in Oklahoma, an immigrant is beaten and lying along the side of the road. If you choose to be a Good Samaritan, you have just committed a felony in Oklahoma. So part of what we are doing in our country is we are passing laws that cut against the grain or the heart of the Christian tradition. And through these faith communities, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, we are trying to say this shall not stand. We cannot have this continue.
During the Civil War, there were severe penalties for harboring runaway slaves in the Underground Railroad. So it just occurred to me, has the metaphor of Underground Railroad 2 occurred to you?
Oh, I think it's perfectly appropriate. And I live in a community right now in Byron, Illinois, that was one of the prolific Underground Railroad communities. Lucius Reed was one of the founders of the Underground Railroad in this area. And he brought people in. And, of course, we had Princeton with Owen Lovejoy. And you could not be a Congregationalist in the state of Illinois and own a slave. You were thrown out of the community, the religious community, if you owned a slave and you were a Congregationalist. So, you know, we've long known in our faith communities that there is a difference between the law of humankind and the law of God. And this is a pivotal point. You know, this is a time when, you know, I think, as King pointed out with the Civil Rights Movement during the 60s, this is about, you know, not only the salvation of immigrant peoples, it's about our own salvation. King believed that African-American people, by standing up and by claiming that they were children of God, were saving white communities. And I believe that the same is true today, is that as we stand for immigrant communities, we are saving ourselves, and those people are teaching us the way of salvation.
Well, let me just take a minute to reintroduce our guest. We're speaking with Reverend Mike Mulberry, who began his ministry at Community United Methodist Church here
Community
in
Urbana. United Church
Community
of Christ.
United Church of Christ. I'm sorry. Excuse me for that crossover. In 2003, and he has worked for some years with the New Sanctuary Movement. Which, as I understand it, isn't it correct, Mike, that it's sponsoring Luis Urrea's visit this Friday? Is that right?
It is. It is. Yep.
And we're talking about, among other things, the book The Devil's Highway by Luis Urrea. He won came close to winning the 2005 Pulitzer Prize. He was a finalist for nonfiction. He's also, I understand it, in the Latino Hall of Fame. And he will be here this Friday at the Friday Forum at the University YMCA on campus from 12 to 1 to talk about his book. And again, later that afternoon at Pages for All Ages, there will be a book signing and a reading from the book which intends to put a human face on immigration issues. This will be at Pages for All Ages from 5 to 8, a reading and book signing by Luis Urrea, who is a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois in Chicago. I should also mention that on September 19th, the Friday Forum is featuring the American healthcare system in crisis and the prospects for reform. Robert Rich, Director of Institute of Government and Public Affairs, will be addressing that topic. And on September 26, our Senator Michael Frericks, Illinois Senate 52nd District, will be talking about civil rights and civil liberties. All right. If you would like to talk to our guest, Reverend Mike Mulberry, about this topic of putting a human face on immigration, you can call 333-9455. We have an 800 number as well, 1-800-222-9455. Well, why don't we switch a little bit here? You have intimate knowledge as a result of your work down in Chiapas and other places in Mexico about the political situation. Apparently there's very significant oppression down in Mexico, and even experiment with certain forms of attempts to control social unrest. And we recently saw some of this, some of the patterns of this at the at our two local national conventions, presidential nominating conventions in St. Paul and also in Denver. Are you seeing some parallels here between the two attempts by authorities to attempt to control social unrest of the sort that we're talking about down in Mexico?
Well, what we hear about in the solidarity groups is that Mexico in particular is a proving ground for attempts to try to control social unrest in our own country, that if it works in Mexico, it will work in the United States, and that is controlling the media, controlling marches and protests. There are incredible marches happening in the state of Oaxaca, continue on from the teacher's strike that they had, and they tried to imprison some of the leaders. That did not work, but a good example of what they did early in Oaxaca was they took some of the leaders from the movement and imprisoned them over a day's drive away from their family and any legal representation. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has done the same thing with immigrants here in this country. Is they have taken some people from, like, Maryland and take them to prisons down in the Georgia area. So those kinds of things that are not about justice, but are about, I think, some kind of retribution or punishment out of a very strong hatred and racism are happening in our country. And I do think that what we should recognize is, with that social unrest and those democracy movements in Mexico, really immigration is the safety valve from having all-out revolution happen in Mexico, which would then affect us in the United States, because we are creating, through our strong economic domination of Mexico, we are creating the stressors that lead people out in the need to go north for jobs and for immigration across the border.
Isn't it true that it's a myth that most immigrants from Mexico and other Latin American countries come here to stay? Instead, they come here simply because of the economic stress that they've experienced recently in their own communities, and they're attempting to send money back and hopefully to return to their communities. They don't intend to stay. They intend to come here to rebuild their homes, churches, communities. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's very true. In fact, you know, one of the dynamics that's going on is that in Chiapas, there are whole communities that do not have their heads of household from those people migrating to the United States looking for an alternative to the death that they experience in their own communities. So those families are really left with choices and decisions that we would make no other way ourselves, is you either die with your family in Mexico or try for something more in the United States. And what happens is that then they do send those remittances back, and it's such a profound number that the revenue for Mexico, the second highest revenue, were those remittances behind oil in Mexico at one time. And it also creates disparate or injustice, inequality in their communities, as you maybe have one family on one side of the street that has had nobody leave for the United States, and somebody on the other side of the street that does not have their head of household, but they're receiving money from that person to maybe do a little bit better. And so you begin to build into those communities jealousy that was not there before. And unfortunately, Don, what has happened is that people are beginning to stay in the United States. Some people are returning because of the tanking of our own economy, but because of the situation that we have in the desert right now, people are afraid to go back, fearful that if they try to cross that desert again, they will not be able to make it. So it's heart-wrenching to recognize that we have some stories where you're just going to have some families that are forever split. And, you know, as a result of that, the very human thing happens where you have families that are going on with their lives in the United States, and some of these men even remarry in the United States while they have wives in Mexico, looking for some kind of companionship. So it's a terrible dynamic that we have set up, and I refer to it as the Walmarting of Mexico, where we strip the local economy of its protections. We make everything up for sale, and we use our superior economic power to lower prices to the point where competition is driven out of the area, and competition where in the United States it might be small business like Jerry's IGA. In Mexico, it's small-time farmers. You know, with the passage of NAFTA, 1.3 million small farmers were immediately driven off the land. And then, of course, what Walmart does is once the competition is gone, you raise your prices and you expand your product base. You know, who would ever guess that Walmart would become the largest distributor of organic food in the United States, or, you know, all these gas stations now that we see at Meijer's and Walmart around town. So it's destructive. It destroys communities, as it has done in our country, and it's even worse for Mexico, where it's really hurting some of the poorest of the poor.
What do you say to those listeners who might be sympathetic when they listen to Lou Dobbs on CNN and have questions in their mind about legal immigrants come to this country and do things by the rules? That's usually the rhetoric that's used at the political level.
Yeah.
Yet these illegal aliens show up and expect to be treated with respect by people like you. Aren't they, the listener to Lou Dobbs would say probably to you, isn't it ungodly, immoral to break the law? How do you respond to people who make that move in the argument?
Well, I think, you know, if we have that kind of law and order set up where you put people in impossible choices, you know, that to me just feels kind of like a red herring for what's going on at the level of these folk. I would ask folk who want to do that, you've got an easy way to do that, and that is when there are migrant peoples in Rantoul, either this summer or next summer, go over and spend time with the Rantoul Migrant Education Program over there. You know, that David Requa has done a great job and has been very courageous with the work that he has done. Go over and spend time with those folk and recognize what it means to be legal or illegal in that context and whether that kind of designation matters. And then secondly, I would say, be aware of how many legal work visas we're giving out. It is a very, very small amount. And there
Did you say legal work visas?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we put
certainly not 12 million.
That's right. That's right. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we're facing. And part of recognizing that our immigration policy is broke is one of the values that's espoused by people like Lou Dobbs, and I hate to make Lou the sole whipping boy for this, but one of the values that's espoused is security. And it is not secure to set up a immigration policy where you have 10 to 12 million people in your country that we don't know about, that are undocumented. You would want a situation where you have a much smaller number of people who are trying to do this in a way under the radar. You want to encourage people to kind of join the radar so that you can at least keep track of undocumented people in your country. But that's not something that we do, and I think it shows the hypocrisy of the immigration policy. It also, you know, that hypocrisy can be seen in things like we're spending, what is it, $46 billion on a wall to separate the two countries, and yet we're not going to have that wall cross resorts or the yards of high-income individuals who happen to be large givers to the President Bush presidency. Why, if we say that we are doing this for secure reasons, would we stop the wall there other than to say that wall is really more of a symbol than it is an actuality?
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question for Reverend Mulberry.
Yes, I do. My name is Sonia, and Michael, you and I used to have some conversations years back, which I miss having with you. Anyway, my question is, or my comment is, you mentioned the Rand Toll Migrant Association. I'd like to hear more about ways people can find out more and meet people and talk with people and maybe offer some valuable assistance, not in an imperialist sort of way, but in a true concerned way. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you for your question.
Now I'm racking my brain for Sonias in my life. I think one of the best ways to do, and forgive me, David Requa, if I use your name in vain, but is to contact David Requa for possibilities of that. I think one of the other, some of the other people
Can
are.
Can you spell his last name for the listeners?
Yeah, I'm sorry, R-E-Q-U-A. He is an administrator in the Rand Toul school system. And I think also to talk to people like Martina Miranda Lugo and Marta Betania, who are great people, and they do some great work over there. I think another way that you can be involved and know is to come to the New Sanctuary Movement meetings, which I believe are still being held at Channing Murray on the first Wednesday of the month at 7 o'clock, and you can learn about how to be involved there. So those are some specific people. I think that one of the other people to contact is who works with the Urbanics school system. I believe it's Lucia Maldonado, and talk to her about possibilities. And there are other faith community people, like I mentioned, some of the great leaders in the New Sanctuary Movement, I would suggest going forward. I feel bad to put out any more names because I know that I've forgotten a ton of people, and I don't want to mess with that because we've had such great people working in that movement.
Are there any phone numbers or websites that people can go to, maybe at Community United or elsewhere that you know of that might be helpful?
You could Google the New Sanctuary Movement in Champaign-Urbana, and we have some out-of-date information there right now, but we're hoping, I know the group is hoping to get the information updated, or you could contact me. You can call me at my home phone at 815-406-8063. Or email me at mmulberry@gmail.com. I may be setting myself up for a flurry there, but I'll take that because I think this is too important an issue. This is the civil rights issue for our age. This is a time when we are going to say these people were made in the image of God, or we're going to find reasons to suggest that we have a right to harm people and use hate to manufacture ways of being that will just continue to hurt not only these communities, but ourselves as well.
I believe we have another caller on line one. Hello?
Is that me?
Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question for Reverend Mulberry.
Hi, Mike. This is Bobby from the Friends Meeting.
Speak up just a little bit, please.
And there's one of the other people who's part of the New Sanctuary Movement, Bobby Trist.
We just had a meeting on Wednesday, and we were planning the stuff for this coming Friday. And I can report that there is going to be a preliminary discussion about the book, The Devil's Highway, on September 23rd, Tuesday evening at the Urbana Free Library. And Bernadette Easley and I and Carol Inskeep, Carol's going to get the room for us because she works at the library. And there should be a group starting at Channing Murray and hopefully a group that will meet at the Champaign Library, but don't have dates for those. But if people could come to the book signing at Pages for All Ages, there will be information there. And the New Sanctuary Movement is meeting the first Wednesday. It was changed from the third or the second to the first because some of us had a major conflict. And it's meeting at Channing Murray at 7 p.m. on the first Wednesday of the month.
Thank you, Bobby.
You're welcome. So if people want to get involved, that's the place to come.
And Bobby mentioned one of those other great people who's part of the movement. Bernadette Easley is such an incredible person and such a compassionate heart. You know, the people, one of the things that is great about this movement, Don, is the people that you meet, like Bernadette Easley or Father Tom Royer or some of the other folks that are involved, are just incredible people with incredibly wide hearts and doing incredible things.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for that information. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's talk a little bit about what, for those in our community who might be have braver souls, what are the risks of harboring illegal immigrants these days? What are we facing? And you did mention that in Oklahoma it's a felony offense, and things seem to be moving in that direction generally. What are the risks here in Champaign, and what can we do to blunt this and change this as a civil rights issue?
Well, I think one of the things that can be done is to make it clear that it won't be in our community. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement goes to places where they think it's safe. Mm-hmm. You know, what happened in Iowa with that big raid happened with a huge a person who was very anti-union.
That the kosher factory?
The kosher factory. Mm-hmm. And they were beginning to organize and beginning to think about unionization in that company. And so this basically, this person called ICE in to wipe out the supply of undocumented folk and to bring a whole new slew of people in the next day as a way of saying, you cross me, and this is what will happen. So basically, that person who owned that factory lost a day of work, you know, and what he got was much more power in his plant. So there was a story in Miami, Florida, which I think is instructive for all of us, and that story was, I think it was in Miami, it might have been in another community in Florida, where there was a family that had been in the community for years, and they were undocumented. And the two boys in that family were well-known in the high school, well-liked. One of them was even the student body president, and he was going on to a great school in Florida after high school. ICE came in, took the family, not thinking that they should have taken his cell phone, and he immediately began texting his friends at the high school. The whole high school showed up and surrounded Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and ICE released the family back into the community.
Well, now, that could happen here, couldn't it?
Yeah, I think that could happen here, and I think that that's the kind of thing that we need to recognize is that we as a people are driving this issue. We are the people that can change the world and make a difference in this situation. You know, when did it begin to turn for King during the Civil Rights Movement? Who really knows? But I do believe it began when and changed when people recognized that our values were much more important than anything that could happen to us. I think that this is the movement that will, one of the movements that will save us during this time, and it's really important for us as a community to recognize our own power, to recognize that we are children of God, capable of incredibly divine things, and if we are willing to step out, willing to risk, now the gospel is kind of scary in that regard, is that we have a Savior from the Christian perspective who ends up on a cross for risking that. But what we find out is that there's incredible power from God who is active and with us and walking and marching with us as we walk and march with these immigrant communities.
We just have about 2 minutes. Last question here. As I understand it, you see this whole issue as a basis for a critique, as you put it, of empire. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think empire has a way of moving in the world that basically says our values are victory through violence and warfare and hatred at times. That's how Rome operated. And that's how all the empires had operated before that time for the Jews. And that the critique of that came out from those prophets and through Christ, who said, there are alternative values, and those values have to do with mutual care, compassion, and justice. And if those are recognized as the foundation of the earth, then we can begin to build a world together that that cuts across the grain of empire, and that empires eventually fall. As King said, the arc of history bends towards justice, and that is the great hope of all the great world religions, is that we are going to accomplish this, maybe not in our lifetime, but that the people of compassion and justice will once again lead us.
Well, Reverend Mulberry, thank you very, very much for joining us. It was a privilege talking to you. We've been talking to Reverend Mike Mulberry.
Thank you, Don.
Senior minister at Community United Church of Christ. Oh. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Thank you all for being with us. We've been talking about a book that was published in 2004 by Luis Urrea. He will be here Friday to read from The Devil's Highway at the University YMCA Friday Forum at 12 o'clock. And you can also see him do a reading and a signing at 5 o'clock at Pages for All Ages. This is Don Nolan. This is Keeping the Faith. Thank you very much for being with us. See you again next Sunday.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Do you have the strange feeling you've heard this before?
Well, it's only fitting, because we're going to explore déjà vu on the next edition of To the Best of Our Knowledge. We'll try to find out what causes us to think we've already experienced the exact same situation before. I'm Jim Fleming. Join us for To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7. Next time on PRI's The World, Pakistan has a new president. Washington hopes that means better cooperation in the fight against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Both groups have used Pakistan as a staging ground for raids in Afghanistan. U.S. and Afghan officials want that to change. Hopes for new leadership in Pakistan next time on The World, Monday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Super Value, Champaign; Colonial Pantry, Champaign; Lincoln Diagnostics Incorporated, Decatur; and Family Video Movie Club, Springfield. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
My wife and I are standing at the door to